operations can be and should be controlled, at least to a large degree, by markets rather than government regulators. People's decisions about what products or what shares to buy are, within these models, expected to have a political character, to serve as effective public interest constraints on corporate behavior. The models, and Jackson's and Monk's prescriptions are examples of two broader ideas known respectively as consumer democracy and shareholder democracy, are not entirely implausible. Corporations do sometimes modify their behavior in positive ways to please or placate shareholders and consumers. They fall far short, however, of providing effective and reliable substitutes for government regulation. One premise of democracy is that, as citizens, all people are equal, at least within the political sphere. Everyone has one vote, regardless of his or her wealth or social position, and that means, in relation to corporations, that every citizen has an equal say about how these powerful entities must behave. Moving regulation of corporations from government to the market immunizes them to the effects of citizens' participation in the political process and leaves their control to an institution where $1, not one person, equals one vote. At least in a democracy, each person is formally equal, says political economist Elaine Bernard, executive director of the Trade Union Program at Harvard University. The humblest citizen, the most prestigious citizen, still only has one vote. But when we move that power over to the marketplace, the humblest and the wealthiest are totally asymmetrical. And one has such immense power that they can literally crush the other completely and utterly and fully. So that's one of the reasons, historically, we've always felt the need to regulate markets. To say, as Jackson does, that consumers are the kings and queens of the new capitalism conveniently ignores the fact most of the world's population is too poor to participate in the consumer economy, as Jackson himself acknowledges in recognizing that 3 billion of us still live in poverty. And even those who do participate in consumer markets are likely to have radically unequal amounts of disposable income, meaning that some of them have many votes, while others have very few. Hardly a formula for anything worth calling democracy. Moreover, it is dubious to presume, as Jackson must, that consumers make decisions about what to buy with social or environmental purposes in mind. Typical is the woman Charles Kernahan describes meeting in the toy department of a Walmart store. When he asked her if she was concerned about where and how the toys had been manufactured, she replied, "I feel very uncomfortable. I've heard so many horrible stories. But what can I do? My kids want these toys." Harvard Business School expert Deborah Spar confirms Kernahan's anecdotal experience when she says that there's no evidence that when people walk into the store, their buying practices will change because of social and environmental concerns. Like Jackson's model, Monk's proposal to rely upon shareholders as a proxy for the public good presumes that $1, or more accurately, one share, equals one vote. And though it may be true that in the United States, roughly half of the population owns some corporate stock and thus can participate in a shareholder democracy, the other half are entirely disenfranchised. And even among those who do own shares and thus have votes, most own relatively few, meaning that they have very little voting power. When developing countries, where very few people own any shares at all, are considered, the case for shareholder democracy is further weakened. Moreover, even though people who own shares in companies may have concerns about social and environmental issues, their decisions to buy, hold, or sell those shares are likely to be driven mainly by financial self-interest rather than social and environmental concerns. Indeed, Munks's own work as a shareholder activist is focused exclusively on protecting the long-term financial interests of his clients. When asked whether he had reduced harms caused by corporate externalities at the many companies he has helped reform, his simple answer was no. Finally, even if significant numbers of consumers and shareholders were prepared to consider social and environmental concerns when making their decisions, a large problem still remains. How do they get the necessary information to do this effectively? Corporations have no incentive to reveal their misdeeds to the public, and the non-governmental organizations that monitor their activities, though valiant in their efforts and ever more effective with the internet at their disposal, nonetheless operate on shoestring budgets and lack the legal authority to compel corporations to disclose information. They cannot serve as substitutes for regulatory agencies, which have, or should have, the necessary resources and legal powers to inspect sites, compel disclosure, and enforce standards. According to Harvard's Deborah Spar, though corporate misdeeds are occasionally revealed through the work of non-governmental organizations and the media, the process is still sporadic and insufficient, more like a highly mobile spotlight on corporations than a fixed and powerful floodlight. You're going to need to have some combination of moral and market norms and formal government sanctions, she says. Ultimately, you can't rely on the media and public pressure to tell corporations what to do. Charles Kernahan, who sifts through garbage dumps in the developing world in search of clues about where factories are hidden and what is going on inside of them, is well aware of the limitations of non-governmental organizations, such as his own National Labor Committee. He agrees with Spar that formal government sanctions are necessary and believes that effective government regulation is the only hope for stopping corporate abuse. His organization and others like it, he says, can complement the democratic process but not replace it. They can provide citizens with education and information that will enable them to demand that governments pass laws against corporate abuse. But getting those laws in place must be the ultimate goal. The global sweatshop economy will not be ended without enforceable human rights and workers' rights standards. It cannot be done, he says. It will never be done on the back of voluntary codes and privatization and monitoring. Never. It has to be laws. Many activists agree with Kernahan that enforceable laws enacted by government, regulations, must be at the heart of any effective strategy to curtail corporate harms and exploitation. Simon Billinus of Boston's Trillium Asset Management, a socially oriented investment firm that recently joined forces with Greenpeace and other environmental groups to spearhead a shareholders' resolution to stop BP from drilling on Alaska's coastal plain, says the belief that non-governmental solutions can replace government regulation is just a bunch of crap. Shareholder resolutions, he says, though useful for drawing public attention to corporate misdeeds, are not in any way a substitute for effective government regulation. Social investors and other activists can nip at the heels of companies, he continues. But in the end, corporations must be subject to democratic control. Regulation, if you want. When, in 1933, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis likened corporations to Frankenstein monsters, there was more to his observation than rhetorical flair. Governments create corporations much like Dr. Frankenstein created his monster. Yet, once they exist, corporations, like the monster, threaten to overpower their creators. The regulatory system was designed to keep the Frankenstein monster on a chain and stop it from causing harm. as Justice Brandeis reasoned in the judicial opinion in which he drew the Frankenstein analogy. Regulations, such as those that protect the environment from destruction, workers from death and injury, and consumers from faulty and dangerous products and exploitative advertising, require corporations by law to be socially and environmentally responsible, rather than trusting and hoping that they will be. They reflect decisions about appropriate standards for corporate behavior that are made by an institution, government, whose sole purpose, unlike the corporation's, is to protect and promote the public interest and reflect the people's will. Government regulation, unlike market-based solutions, combines authority, capacity, and democratic legitimacy to protect citizens from corporate misdeeds. Through it, governments can pursue social values such as democracy, social justice, citizens' health and welfare, environmental integrity, cultural identity, that lie beyond the narrow goals of self-interest and wealth maximization that dictate the behavior of corporations and markets. Milton Friedman, who believes we need a great deal more deregulation, is, he boasts, noted for the phrase that there is no free lunch. The phrase has application here. There is no free lunch with deregulation. No doubt costs are created by regulation and benefits are derived from deregulation's removal of those costs. Corporations become more profitable when relieved of regulatory restrictions that prevent them from externalizing their costs. Consumers sometimes benefit from lower prices. Governments, and thus taxpayers, save money when they're able to cut the budgets of regulatory agencies. In most cases, however, the costs saved by deregulation only reappear elsewhere, a point underlined by earlier stories of victims of corporate misdeeds, who might have been or might yet be saved from their ordeals by effective regulation. Norma Cassie and her Gwich'in people, Patricia Anderson and her family, Wendy Diaz and the young women she works with, Don Shugak, the Cook Creek miners, sweatshop workers in New York and Los Angeles, and children made sick or obese by unhealthy food pitched to them on television. Regulations are designed to force corporations to internalize, i.e., pay for, costs they would otherwise externalize onto society and the environment. When they are effective and effectively enforced, they have the potential to stop corporations from harming and exploiting individuals, communities, and the environment. Deregulation is really a form of de-democratization, as it denies the people, acting through their democratic representatives in government, the only official political vehicle they currently have to control corporate behavior. Despite that, a growing number of activists, not just business people, eschew government solutions. They believe, with some justification, that government has lost its capacity to contain corporate power. People should confront corporations directly in the streets and through non-governmental organizations and community coalitions, they say, rather than relying on governments to forge solutions. We should be directly pointing the finger at businesses, not even bothering with the governments, says Anita Roddick, reflecting a widely held view that is also expressed by anti-globalization activist and pundit Naomi Klein. We see corporations as the most powerful political entities of our time, and we are responding to them as citizens, citizens to political organizations. The corporation has become the new site of protest. Rather than protesting on the doorsteps of governments on Sunday afternoon when no one's there, they're protesting outside of the Nike Town on Fifth Avenue. Though the movement against corporate rule would be impossible, even senseless, without robust non-governmental institutions, community activism, and political dissent, the belief these can be a substitute for government regulation rather than a necessary complement to it is dangerously mistaken. Many among the corporate elite and their defenders would likely sing hallelujah the day activists against corporate abuse abandoned government. That is, after all, what many business leaders want. Replacement of government regulation of corporations with market forces, perhaps shaped by the oversight of non-governmental organizations with no legal powers, and the demands of conscientious consumers and shareholders, with minimal effects. In this scenario, corporations get all the coercive power and resources of the state, while citizens are left with non-governmental organizations and the market's invisible hand. Socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor, to borrow a phrase from George Bernard Shaw. There is little democracy in a system that relies on market forces and non-governmental organizations to promote socially responsible behavior from corporations. Benevolent corporations, like benevolent tyrants, may be better than malevolent ones, but as Noam Chomsky observes, it is better to ask why we have tyranny than whether it can be benevolent. Corporations are not democratic institutions. Their directors and managers owe no accountability to anyone but the shareholders that employ them. The belief that corporate benevolence and social responsibility can and should be achieved through market forces to the point where government regulation becomes unnecessary is premised on a dangerous diminishment of the importance of democracy. Democratic governments, despite all their flaws, are, at least in theory, accountable to the whole of society. Admittedly, the actual practices of the regulatory system fall short of the democratic ideals that inform it. Regulatory capture, a term coined by economist George Stigler in the 1960s, to describe corporations' domination of regulatory agencies through lobbying and selective information sharing, is endemic. Many corporations regularly breach regulatory laws, confident that they won't be caught or that if they are, the financial benefits derived from the breach will exceed the costs of the fines assessed against them. Regulatory agencies tend to be understaffed, unaccountable, and peopled by bureaucrats, many of whom are drawn from the industries being regulated, who see themselves as partners with industry rather than its overseers, and the standards established by regulatory laws often are reactive rather than preventive and too weak to stop corporations from causing serious harm to people and the environment. More generally, the democratic system as a whole ill serves its animating ideals. Broad public participation in self-government is absent, as people's participation is limited to occasional voting, and close to half the population does not even do that. Politicians are unduly pressured and influenced by corporate money and increasingly deprived of meaningful decision-making powers as deregulation and privatization roll back government's domain. The public sphere is shrinking and social inequality is rampant. Despite all of this, however, as Chomsky states, whatever one thinks of governments, they're to some extent publicly accountable, to a limited extent. Corporations are to a zero extent. One of the reasons why propaganda tries to get you to hate government is because it's the one existing institution in which people can participate to some extent and constrain tyrannical, unaccountable power. Though the existing regulatory system and the political system as a whole are flawed and fall short of the democratic ideals that sustain them, they have the potential, which governance by a combination of corporations, the market, and non-governmental institutions does not, to govern society democratically. Now is the time to reinvigorate, not abandon, democratic institutions, and to craft them into truer reflections of the ideals upon which they were founded. But is it too late for that? Is government now so dominated by corporate power that it will never be able to regain control of corporations? Sometimes it feels that way. The evidence of corporate domination is everywhere. The sheer size of corporations, some of whose economies dwarf those of small nations, the transnational scope of their operations, and their control of society and influence over government. There is surface appeal to the argument that economic globalization and corporate domination more generally have put corporations beyond government's grasp, possibly forever. However, that argument ignores one crucial fact, namely that the corporation depends entirely on government for its existence and is therefore always, at least in theory, within government's control. The corporation was originally conceived as a public institution whose purpose was to serve national interests and advance the public good. In 17th century England, corporations such as the Hudson's Bay Company and the East India Company were chartered by the Crown to run state monopolies in the colonies of England's empire. During the 18th and early 19th centuries, too, in both England and the United States, corporations were formed primarily for public purposes, such as building canals and transporting water. The modern for-profit corporation, programmed solely to advance the private interests of its owners, differs profoundly from these earlier versions of the institution. Yet, in one crucial respect, it remains the same. It is, as it has always been, a product of public policy, a creation of the state. The state is the only institution in the world that can bring a corporation to life. It alone grants corporations their essential rights, such as legal personhood and limited liability, and it compels them always to put profits first. It raises police forces and armies and builds courthouses and prisons, all compulsorily paid for by citizens, to enforce corporations' property rights, rights themselves created by the state. And only the state, in conjunction with other states, can enter into international trade deals and create global institutions, such as the World Trade Organization, that in turn limit its ability to regulate the corporations and property rights it has created. Without the state, the corporation is nothing, literally nothing. It is therefore a mistake to believe that because corporations are now strong, the state has become weak. Economic globalization and deregulation have diminished the state's capacity to protect the public interest through, for example, labor laws, environmental laws, and consumer protection laws, and have strengthened its power to promote corporations' interests and facilitate their profit-seeking missions through, for example, corporate laws, property and contract laws, copyright laws, and international trade laws. Overall, however, the state's power has not been reduced. It has been redistributed, more tightly connected to the needs and interests of corporations, and less so to the public interest. Thus, it is only partly true to say, as Daniel Yergin and Joseph Stanislaw do in The Commanding Heights, that the general movement away from traditional state control of the commanding heights of the economy continues, leaving it more to the realm of the market. While that statement captures the diminishing role of the state in protecting citizens from corporations, it ignores the expanding role of the state in protecting corporations from citizens. The question is never whether the state regulates corporations. It always does, but how and in whose interests it does so. Beguiled by the natural entity conception of corporations, the notion that they are independent persons, we tend to forget that they are entirely dependent upon the state for their creation and empowerment. That, in turn, destroys any special basis for state regulation of the corporation that derives from its creation by the state, as historian Morton Horwitz describes the ideological effects of the natural entity theory. The new dealers understood this. They knew that the natural entity theory and related laissez-faire doctrines undermined the legitimacy of regulations designed to promote the public interest. So they discarded those ideas and revived earlier conceptions of corporations and markets as creations of government. The freedom from regulation postulated by laissez-faire adherents is demonstrably non-existent and virtually inconceivable, wrote one New Deal supporter in 1935. Bargaining power exists only because of government protection of the property rights bargained and is properly subject to government control. Such ideas had been around even before the New Deal. Robert Hale stated in 1922 that the dependence of present economic conditions, in part at least, on the government's past policy concerning the distribution of the public domain must be obvious. Laissez-faire is a utopian dream, which never has been and never can be realized. The Norris-LaGuardia Act, the most important piece of New Deal labor legislation, rehearsed similar logic in its preamble as justification for restrictions on employers' property rights. Whereas under prevailing economic conditions, developed with the aid of governmental authority for owners of property to organize in the corporate and other forms of ownership association, the individual worker is commonly helpless to exercise actual liberty of contract and protect his freedom of labor, and thereby to obtain acceptable terms and conditions of employment. Corporations cannot exist without the state, nor can markets. Deregulation does not scale back the state's involvement with corporations, it simply changes its nature. As a creation of government, the corporation must be measured against the standard applicable to all government policies. Does it serve the public interest? The 19th century judges and legislators who refashioned the corporation into a self-interested institution never really abandoned that idea. Rather, with laissez-faire ideas dominant at the time, they embraced a new conception of what the public interest required. It would best be served, they thought, if individuals, including corporations, were enabled to pursue their self-interest unimpeded by government. Out of that belief developed a kind of circular logic, still in place today, that justified, and justifies, government's facilitation of the interests of corporations. To wit, if serving corporations' interests advances the public good, then the public good is advanced when corporations' interests are served. Or, as Charles Wilson, a former president of General Motors and Secretary of Defense, told a U.S. Senate subcommittee in the 1930s, "What is good for General Motors is good for the country." More recently, Dr. Harriet Smith Windsor, Secretary of State for Corporations in Delaware, a state whose major industry is manufacturing corporations, half of Fortune 500 and NYSE companies are incorporated there, 27% of the state's $2.3 billion yearly revenue is derived from incorporation business, rehearsed a similar logic when she observed, "Our laws are geared to help business, to meet their needs." Her assistant secretary of state, Rick Geisenberger, added, "We write our laws in a way that enable businesses to flourish and people to access capital." That is good public policy only if you presume that what's best for business is best for the public, a presumption that drives much public policy today. However, the fact that corporate law and policy rest upon a conception of the public good, albeit a narrow one, only confirms that the concept of the public good remains the ultimate measure of the corporation's institutional worth and legitimacy. As a concrete reflection of this, most corporate law statutes include provisions that permit governments to dissolve a corporation or seek a court order to dissolve it if the government believes that the corporation has grossly violated the public interest. Charter revocation laws, as these provisions are known, have always been a part of corporate law. They suggest a government can destroy a corporation as easily as it can create one, and symbolize the obvious, though easily forgotten, idea that in a democracy, corporations exist at the pleasure of the people and under their sovereignty. As New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer remarked in reference to these laws, if a corporation is convicted of repeated felonies that harm or endanger the lives of human beings or destroy our environment, the corporation should be put to death, its corporate existence ended, and its assets taken and sold at public auction. Charter revocation laws are a well-kept secret, according to law professor Robert Benson, who, using California's charter revocation law, recently petitioned that state's attorney general to dissolve the Union Oil Company of California, UNOCL, by revoking its charter. The people mistakenly assume that we have to try to control these giant corporate repeat offenders one toxic spill at a time, one layoff at a time, one human rights violation at a time. But the law has always allowed the attorney general to go to court to simply dissolve a corporation for wrongdoing and sell its assets to others who will operate in the public interest. Benson listed UNOCL's alleged transgressions in his 127-page application to the attorney general. The company had collaborated on a pipeline project with the outlaw Burmese military regime, which had allegedly used slave labor on the pipeline and forced whole villages to relocate. It had allegedly collaborated on projects with Afghanistan's former Taliban regime, which was notorious for its violations of human rights long before the United States waged war against it. It had, the application claimed, persistently violated California's environmental and employee safety regulations. The application was rejected by the Attorney General's office 5 days after it was filed. Benson never really expected to succeed with his application. Though governments often resort to charter revocation laws to dissolve small corporations for technical infractions, California suspended 58,000 corporations for tax evasion and failure to file proper statements in 2001 to 2002. Delaware revoked roughly half that number in the same period. The remedy is not used to punish large corporations for major infractions. Even Enron was spared this corporate death penalty and continues to exist as a corporate entity. I never saw the biggest payoff of filing charter revocation suits as being able to get rid of UNOCL or any specific company, says Benson. I saw the payoff as changing the climate of public opinion against corporate malfeasance, and I think we helped do that. Corporate charter revocation laws, he says, symbolize the fact that corporations are our creations and that we, the people, still have the power to control them. The time has come to use that power, not only by activating charter revocation laws, but also more generally by subjecting corporations to robust democratic controls. The corporation is not an independent person with its own rights, needs, and desires that regulators must respect. It is a state-created tool for advancing social and economic policy. As such, it has only one institutional purpose: to serve the public interest, and not some circular conception of the public interest that equates it with the interests of business. We must work to ensure that that is what corporations do. But how can the corporation, which is currently constituted as a psychopathic institution, be made to respect and promote the public interest? The question of what to do about and with the corporation is one of the most pressing and difficult of our time. There are no easy answers, no blueprints for change, and we should be wary of people who offer them. As a society, we have created a difficult problem for ourselves. We have, over the last 300 years, constructed a remarkably efficient wealth-creating machine, but it is now out of control. Though solutions to this problem must ultimately be democratically fashioned by the people, not by a law professor sitting in front of his computer, I do want to conclude with some general thoughts about how we might move forward. To begin with, tinkering with corporate governance is not enough. Though post-Enron proposals for the reform of corporate governance and measures such as those found in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act are likely to strengthen managers' and directors' accountability to investors, they will do little to improve corporate accountability to society as a whole. Broader reforms, such as tighter restrictions on acquisitions and mergers, representation of stakeholders, union representatives, for example, on boards of directors, and laws that permit or require executives to consider stakeholder interests in their business decisions, so-called constituency statutes, though desirable, are unlikely to strengthen corporations' accountability to society in significant ways. At the other extreme, proposals based upon visions of corporationless futures leave unsolved the problem of what to do about and with corporations right now. Though it may be true that millions of people are saying not only do we not need corporations, we can do it better. We are going to create systems that nourish the earth and nourish human beings, as activist Vandana Shiva states. A corporationless future is, for now, too remote a possibility to plan for. As Harvard Business School pundit Joe Badaracco says, this institution, the corporation, is going to be around for a very long period. It may have rough sledding for a decade or two, it did arguably a decade or two ago, but I think its resilience has already been demonstrated and the opportunities for it to grow even stronger are really astonishing. It seems reasonable to presume and plan for the fact that the corporation, though vulnerable as all other dominant institutions have been in the longer sweep of history, will remain present and powerful in society in at least the medium-range future. What about remaking the corporation, changing it into a non-psychopathic entity? That is what proponents of social responsibility and ethical management claim they are doing. Yet, despite their often good intentions, they are profoundly limited by the corporation's legal mandate to pursue, without exception, its own self-interest, as I've argued in previous chapters. To reform the corporation meaningfully, that mandate would have to be changed. Corporations would have to be reconstituted to serve, promote, and be accountable to broader domains of society than just themselves and their shareholders. Such corporations already exist, and we deal with them on a daily basis. The U.S. Postal Service, a self-supporting corporation wholly owned by the U.S. federal government, is one example, as its legislated mission indicates. The Postal Service shall have as its basic function the obligation to provide postal services to bind the nation together through the personal, educational, literary, and business correspondence of the people. It shall provide prompt, reliable, and efficient services to patrons in all areas and shall render postal services to all communities. Public purpose corporations operate in numerous other public service domains: transportation, utilities, broadcasting, and security and rescue services, to name a few examples, and are, as I suggested in Chapter 4, preferable to for-profit corporations for delivering key public programs and services. But should all corporations become public purpose corporations? Is that the solution to our current corporate woes? Such a solution, even if desirable, is currently too utopian to be realistically proposed. Perhaps someday we shall understand how truly to democratize economic relations, and widespread use of public-purpose corporations may be a key part of the plan. In the meantime, however, in the near to medium-range future, in terms of what we can do tomorrow, next week, and next year, realism dictates, presuming that the corporation's constitution will remain much as it is, self-interested to the point of psychopathy. It bears stating here that the corporation is an institutional reflection of the principles of laissez-faire capitalism. Changing it must be understood as part of a larger project of economic change. The challenge for now is to find ways to control the corporation, to subject it to democratic constraints, and protect citizens from its dangerous tendencies, even while we hope and strive in the longer term for a more fully human and democratic economic order. Improving the legitimacy, effectiveness, and accountability of government regulation is currently the best, or at least the most realistic, strategy for doing this. To that end, I offer the following general prescriptions. Improve the regulatory system. Government regulation should be reconceived and re-legitimated as the principal means for bringing corporations under democratic control and ensuring that they respect the interests of citizens, communities, and the environment. Regulations should be made more effective by staffing enforcement agencies at realistic levels, setting fines sufficiently high to deter corporations from committing crimes, strengthening the liability of top directors and managers for their corporations' illegal behaviors, barring repeat offender corporations from government contracts, and suspending the charters of corporations that flagrantly and persistently violate the public interest. Regulations designed to protect the environment and people's health and safety should be based upon the precautionary principle, which prescribes that corporations be prohibited from acting in ways that are reasonably likely to cause harm, even if definitive proof that such harm will occur does not exist. The regulatory system should be reformed to improve accountability and avoid both agency capture and the centralized and bureaucratic tendencies of current and past regimes. Local government bodies, such as city councils and school and park boards, should play greater roles in the regulatory system, as they are often more accessible to citizens than federal and state agencies, and more willing and able to forge alliances with citizen groups around particular issues, as they have done effectively in relation to, among other things, restrictions on advertising in schools, urban sprawl, box retailers, and environmentally damaging practices. The roles of trade unions and other workers' associations in monitoring and regulating the behavior of corporations should be protected and enhanced, as should those of environmental, consumer, human rights, and other organizations that represent interests and constituencies affected by what corporations do. Strengthen political democracy. Elections should be publicly financed, corporate political donations phased out, and tighter restrictions imposed on lobbying and the revolving door flow of personnel between government and business. Though corporations have a place in representing their concerns to government and cooperating with government on policy initiatives, the special status they currently enjoy as partners with government endangers the democratic process. At a minimum, their influence should be scaled back to a degree more commensurate with that of other organizations, such as unions, environmental and consumer groups, and human rights advocates. Electoral reforms that would bring new voices into the political system and encourage disillusioned citizens to return to it, such as proportional representation, should be pursued. Create a robust public sphere. social groups and interests judged to be important for the public good, or too precious, vulnerable, or morally sacred to subject to corporate exploitation, should be governed and protected by public regimes. Inevitably, people will debate the extent to which such groups and interests should be immune to corporate exploitation, the kinds of measures that should be used to protect them, and what groups and interests should be protected. Children's minds and imaginations, schools, universities, cultural institutions, water and power utilities, health and welfare services, police, courts, prisons, firefighters, parks, nature reserves, genes and other biological materials, and public space are all likely candidates. But these are healthy debates to have, far healthier than the increasingly prevalent presumption that no public interest exists beyond the accumulated financial interests of individual corporations, consumers, and shareholders. Challenge international neoliberalism. Nations should work together to shift the ideologies and practices of international institutions such as the WTO, IMF, and World Bank away from market fundamentalism and its facilitation of deregulation and privatization. The current ideological biases of these institutions are not written in stone. Indeed, their original mandate, formulated at Bretton Woods, reflected the economic theories of John Maynard Keynes, and thus a very different orientation than they have today. Most important, we must remember the most subversive truth of all, that corporations are our creations. They have no lives, no powers, and no capacities beyond what we, through our governments, give them. We live in a world full of fear. People are afraid of the dark. People are afraid of losing their jobs. People are afraid of speaking. People are afraid of giving their opinion. People are afraid of acting, according to Oscar Oliveira, a union official who led a popular uprising against privatization of the freshwater system in Cochabamba, Bolivia. It's time that we lose our fear and develop the capacity to unite, to organize, and to recover our faith in ourselves and in others. That is what Oliveira and the people of Cochabamba recently did. It all began when the Bolivian government, under pressure from the World Bank to privatize water utilities, contracted with Aguas del Tunari, the major shareholder of which is Bechtel subsidiary International Water Limited, to run the water system of Cochabamba, a water-starved region in central Bolivia. At the time, Cochabamba was served by an old and decaying system that did not reach areas of the countryside where many peasants lived. Aguas del Tunari, when it took over the system, raised rates to up to 3 times what they had been and began charging peasants for water they drew from their own wells. The government, in compliance with its contract with the company, passed a law that prohibited people from collecting water from local lagoons, rivers, and deltas, and even rainwater. The company confiscated people's alternative water systems without compensation and placed them under its control. All of these actions, including the rate increases, which imposed severe hardships on many people, according to Oliveira, were justified by the company as necessary to meet contractually mandated profit levels. People organized in the city and in the countryside with the help of Oliveira and others and demanded that the company leave, which it did eventually, but only after bloody confrontations between citizens and the police and military. We started to see many injured youths, young people at 16 or 17 years old who lost arms, legs, were left paralyzed, had brain and nervous system injuries, had one young man, Victor Hugo Daza, killed, and there had been 5 people killed in the countryside, recalls Oliveira. It was a victory at a real great cost. It was still a victory, however, and not just for water, according to Oliveira, but for The struggle for justice, the struggle for democracy, and the struggle for the change of the living conditions of the people. We saw this incredible capacity of people to organize, to unify, and to be in solidarity with each other. At one point, it was so strong and people were coming together so much. There were 100,000 people in the streets, and there were people from all sectors of society, rich and poor, peasants, women, seniors, young people. And the incredible thing was that people were really starting to feel powerful, feeling that they had the power to make decisions about the water. And finally, they did decide about the water. And I think for the first time in a long time, young and old had the chance to taste, to really savor democracy. Because, as we have always said, democracy is about who makes decisions. The only sovereign is the people, and no one else. The Water Corporation was deprivatized and returned to the people of Cochabamba. Oliveira now dreams of making it a truly social corporation that really involves people in decision-making and solving their problems. Already, he says, the non-profit corporation, with a board of directors composed of local officials and representatives from unions and professional associations, is not only transparent, but more just, more efficient, and encouraging of participation of the people in the solution to their problems. Corporate rule is not inviolable. When people unite and organize and have faith in themselves and one another, their dissatisfaction can become a powerful source of vulnerability for corporations and the governments that support and empower them. No doubt the corporation is a formidable foe, but as Oliveira says, small battles are being won around the world, including his and the people of Cochabamba's. Restoring broad democratic control over the corporation is a large battle, but it is one that must be fought. Corporate rule must be challenged in order to revive the values and practices it contradicts: democracy, social justice, equality, and compassion. The corporation and its underlying ideology are animated by a narrow conception of human nature that is too distorted and too uninspiring to have lasting purchase on our political imaginations. Though individualistic self-interest and consumer desires are core parts of who we are and nothing to be ashamed about, they are not all of who we are. We also feel deep ties and commitments to one another, that we share common fates and hopes for a better world. We know that our values, capacities, aesthetics, and senses of meaning and justice are, in part, created and nurtured by our communal attachments. We believe that some things are too vulnerable, precious, or important to exploit for profit. We don't have to see ourselves primarily as rapacious producers and consumers of goods who function in ways that are competitive and self-interested, as philosopher Mark Kingwell says. Humans have organized themselves, by and large, for vast stretches of what we call civilization in other ways. The best argument against corporate rule is to look at who we really are and to understand how poorly the corporation's tenets reflect us. We are basically organisms of feeling, of empathy, says scientist and activist Dr. Mae Wan Ho. When other people suffer, we suffer. We want a safe, equitable, just, and compassionate world because it is a matter of life and death to us. Dr. Vandana Shiva, another scientist turned activist, notes that in every period of history, people have risen up against systems that are based on illegitimate measures and that deny people the right and freedoms to live and survive with dignity. No social and ideological order that represses essential parts of ourselves can last, a point as true of the corporate order as it was for the fallen communist one. We only have to remember who we are and what we are capable of as human beings to reveal how dangerously distorted is the corporation's order of narrow self-interest. How does a free people govern themselves? Asks Richard Grossman of the Boston-based Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. I mean, in a sense, this is all not about the corporation. It's about us as human beings, our role on the earth, our temporal span, our lifespan. What are we to do with ourselves? How we come together with other people to govern ourselves, to live in harmony with other creatures on the earth, to live in harmony with the earth itself, to live in harmony with the future generations, including the children of men and women who work in corporations. It's really about us. That is why I am optimistic, because it really is about us. This is Rebecca Jenkins. We hope you've enjoyed this recording of The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power by Joel Bakken. This program was produced by Post-Hypnotic Press. Text copyright 2004 by Joel Bakken. Production copyright 2012 by Post-Hypnotic Press. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with the author, Joel Bakken. Check out our recording of Joel Bakken's Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Targets Children, and other books by Post-Hypnotic Press at www.posthypnoticpress.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.